Last time we were in chapter 12. We were channeling chapter 12. And we had talked about, here in chapter 12, we had talked about the parable of the vineyard being a preview of Jesus' rejection and his death. When Jesus tells this parable of the vineyard after the scribes and Pharisees, or maybe that's where we were coming today. Man plants a vineyard, sets a hedge around it. It reminds them of in Isaiah, where Israel is seen as the vineyard of God, who digs around, plants a vineyard, puts a wall, puts a vat in the middle, all this kind of stuff. And he speaks in parables that the man planted this vineyard. We did talk about it briefly because here it kind of presupposes a mission to the Gentiles. Israel has rejected the gospel of God. The religious leaders and the kings over the centuries have rejected the workers and the servants that the owner sent. The owner is God. The servants were the prophets and the priests, some of whom were beaten, most of whom were ridiculed, some even killed over time. And so, eventually, he says, the man will say, I will send my son. Surely, because he's my son and my blood and represents my authority, they will end up listening to him and paying attention to him. And of course, the text says, but the tenant said, this is the heir, let us kill him and the inheritance will be ours. And they took him and killed him and cast him out of the vineyard. Now, what's really interesting is by casting him out of the vineyard too, and this having to do with a preview of Jesus' death and a parable talking about Jesus' upcoming death at the hands of the religious leaders and others, where is Jesus crucified? Outside of the city. And the city was considered in this the vineyard, the working place of God and the people there. And so he is killed and outside here. And he says, okay, what will the owner of the vineyard do? Well, he will come and destroy the tenants. And so what he's saying here is there's a difference. God is not just the God of the Jews, and if he's rejected, he will go on to other people who accept him. And he will give that gospel and that message. Now, Israel's rejection of the gospel of God is the reason the gospel is passing from Israel to the Gentiles, Jesus is saying here. They've rejected, and he knows they're getting ready to reject him again. In fact, the religious leaders, when he made that triumphal entry into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees begin berating him, and in some of the Gospels say, tell these people to be quiet. And Jesus says in Matthew, do that and the stones themselves will rise up and sing. Israel, it's also a warning to the Gentile and Christian leaders not to be haughty. Not to think, oh, well, God took it away from them, now he's giving it to us. Look at us. We're God's chosen people. We're the new chosen people. He said, because just as they fell, if you get as haughty as they did about it and have that attitude, then you too could be rejected because you reject what he is doing. God, as Edward Schweizer says, God is not bound to Israel nor to a particular Christian church if it becomes disobedient. And that's what's happened with Israel. And so he says, have you not read this scripture? The very stone which the builders rejected has become the head of the corner. This was the Lord's doing. And by the way, the word there for Lord, where he is, actually where he is quoting here in verse 10 from Psalm 118, the word in the Hebrew text would have been Yahweh. So speaking of God, not another Lord. So it's all caps here. This was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. It's not because you're so great and wonderful, God does this, and therefore, if you reject God, then God will take what he has given you. It's very similar to the parable of the talents, where the man gave different servants talents, and the last one hid his in the ground and took it away from him and gave it to the others. Why? Because he hadn't done with it what he should have done. And in that way, he was actually rejecting the trust and rejecting the authority of the one who gave it to him. Well, it's the same thing here. He'll give it to those others, that is, the Gentiles. And so here we have, additionally, Jesus, as Mark is writing this, and you've got Christians being persecuted in Nero's Rome, and predominantly Gentile Christians that are being persecuted in Nero's Rome. You know, he's saying, you all need to stand up, you need to do what you're supposed to, because and work with God and follow God, because if you don't, you can be rejected too. If you reject him, then you can be rejected. But he's also saying this message is for you. It's not just for the Jews, it's for you as well. And they tried to arrest him. I mean, all of a sudden, the religious leaders are pretty ticked off. The scribes and the Pharisees in the audience, they're pretty ticked off. And they want to arrest him, but there's a problem. If they'd been by themselves and he was telling it, okay. But they feared the multitude. And this doesn't mean they respected the multitude. They were afraid of the crowd. Because the crowd understood as well. He distinguishes here between the teachers of Israel who want to kill Jesus and the common people who admire him, even though they don't totally understand the mystery. For they perceive that he had told the parable against them. Now, there's some scholars who say that they is scribes and Pharisees, and the common people really didn't understand, but they were afraid Jesus was so popular, they were afraid if they grabbed him, they'd get him. Some scholars say the they is both groups, and I think it is. I think they were afraid because suddenly some in the multitude started getting it. They began to understand and perceive what was going on. And these guys start perceiving it was told against them. And that's what caused the fear. And so they leave him and they go away. The religious leaders leave in this particular instance. It's not Jesus who leaves like he did the other day, like he did on Palm Sunday, or the day he cleansed the temple. When he cleanses the temple in Mark, he does that and then he immediately leaves. So it was later in the day. Well, here, he's not the one that leaves. The scribes and the Pharisees leave to go make their plans in secret. But they end up doing this and thinking about it, and they get together with a group of Herodians. Now, the Herodians, as we've said before, were people who believed they wanted the reign of the king to rule and reign just like Herod the Great had done. They wanted to resurrect the political system. So now you've got Pharisees and Herodians trying to entrap him. So here we've got the religion and the political coming together to try and get Jesus. And when, you know, when the two get together too closely, that doesn't bode well for much of anybody. So they send some of the Pharisees and some of the Herodians to try and entrap him in his talk or in his teaching. So Jesus hangs around. He's still there doing teaching, and they get off in the corner and they go back to their place and say, well, maybe we can get him, religiously and politically. The Herodians, now the Pharisees wouldn't, and this is the tax thing, the tax question, who we pay taxes to. The Pharisees were not happy that they had to use the Herodian coins. But the Herodians wanted to get rid of Jesus so that their political aspirations could rise up and the Pharisees would help them. Actually, in the Old Testament, we were talking in Micah the other week, that oftentimes what happened was in Jerusalem, the politicians and the lawyers set up their offices near the temple, and they would promise to give more money to the temple if the priests would help support them in what they were trying to get the people to do, if they'd help support the laws and all that kind of stuff. And so they, and to get to their offices, the offices of politicians, you had to walk by the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And when you left there, you had to go back by too. And so they were in cahoots with each other back then. And Micah speaks against that as well. So some of them come and they say, teacher, we know you're true. You are true and care for no man, for you do not regard the position of men, but truly teach the way of God. In other words, they said, we know that you don't show partiality. In fact, you don't bow and scrape to the government. You don't bow and scrape to us either. You're an equal opportunity insulter. You insult the religious leadership and you insult the political leadership. And so they say, you know, we know, but what they're trying to do is just like Nicodemus had done in John, where he comes, Jesus said, teacher, we know that you're a man come from God because nobody can do the things you do if God weren't with him. And you almost get him getting ready to say, but how can you? You know, he's trying to get him puffed up and catch him off guard. And that's what they're trying to do here. Say, oh, we know that you teach the law of God and we know that you care about all these people and you don't show partiality. I mean, you don't just hang around with us. You hang around with all these other folks. But is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Now, this centers around the poll tax. The poll tax that was instituted in A.D. 6 and by Tiberius. The zealots hated to pay it. Of course, nobody really likes to pay taxes, right? The zealots hated to pay it because it, you know, they wanted another political system, and it, in some ways, if you paid the poll tax and you paid it with that money, you were agreeing to Tiberius, they thought, and his rule. The Pharisees didn't like it because it was Roman money rather than their temple shekels. But they're willing to get together here to try and get Jesus because Jesus has embarrassed them a couple of times there in the temple area. But they're also trying to get, I mean, if they can get Jesus to say, oh yeah, you folks, well, who's around? The majority of folks around. They're the common people who don't have the money and don't want to pay the taxes anyway and are overtaxed. And if they can get Jesus to say, well, yeah, you need to go ahead and pay everything they ask, well, then he's going to fall out of favor with these guys. And Herodians are going to be happy. But if he says, no, don't pay taxes at all, then the Herodians have got him and they can go to Pontius Pilate and say, listen, this guy's saying none of these people should pay you all the taxes that you're owed. But what's even more at stake here is the particular coin on the denarius for the poll tax read, Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus. And by divine, it didn't mean he was just really nice and great and wonderful. It meant he was a god. And if Tiberius then is son of a god, Tiberius himself is a god. So they saw to accept that tax and to pay that tax money, that denarius with that on it, even the Pharisees saw that as being slanderous towards God. And so they say, should we pay them or should we not? But Jesus knew what they were doing. He knew of their hypocrisy. And in fact, it says, but knowing their hypocrisy, he said to them, why put me to the test? Give me a coin. Let me look at it. And they do. And of course, this is where he says, whose likeness and inscription? They said, Caesar's. Jesus said, then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. And of course, the Pharisees are starting to think, now all these people are going to, but give to God what belongs to God. And the whole idea is it's that coin is minted with the image of Caesar. So it says, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. Pay the taxes. But you are in the image of God. Therefore, you should give to God what belongs to God. And as image of God, he's saying you should give yourself to God, and that's something that Caesar can't take. Once again, think about when Mark is writing this, during the time when Nero, Caesar, is persecuting Christians. That's a pretty harsh statement, a pretty hard statement for him to remind them, say, well, you know, yeah. Nero, who is Caesar, is persecuting you and torturing you and killing you, but give to Caesar whatever Caesar takes because you're giving yourself to God. If you give yourself to God, then you're going to be vindicated. But that's still pretty hard. Who wants to walk up to the machine gun, or in that case, the bows and arrows and spears? And those kinds of things. And they were amazed at him. They're amazed at, they tried to paint him in a corner and he stayed out of the corner. He stayed out of the corner. Now that will also come back later in 1 Peter and 2 Peter, where the writer of 1 and 2 Peter says you should honor the emperor and pray for the government. even if they're mean, because Jesus himself set the example. So, you know, it still goes back then, or at that particular point in time as well. Well, the Pharisees have failed. The Sadducees, Caiaphas, his father-in-law Annas, and others, the rich guys now, come up to him, and they question him. In fact, their question for entrapment is even more ridiculous. Because remember, we've said that the Pharisees believed in rewards and punishments in the afterlife, and they believed there'd be a bodily resurrection at the end, that when you died, your soul went to one side or the other of Hades, and there you waited for the end of time, and then your body would be reunited with your soul, and if it was good and you were going to paradise, it'd be a new kind of body, or a complete body and whole, and it would go to paradise. And if it wasn't, there were two different, the Rabbi Shammai taught that, your body would be reunited with your soul. It would go into the flames and be purged. Then it would go, if you were Jewish, then it would go to paradise after it was purged. And if you weren't, it'd be completely burned up. There wasn't a permanency to that punishment in the Jewish teaching. It was, you're burned for a while and then you're gone. And so, you know, the Sadducees didn't even believe in rewards and punishments in the afterlife. They taught if you're rewarded or punished, you get it in this life. And when everybody dies, you go to Sheol. That's it. Sheol's the underworld, a place in the Old Testament where David says, I can go, the child dies and he says, he can't come to me, but I can go to him and I will go down to Sheol. Sheol was a place under the earth where that part of you that was in early to mid-Jewish teaching, that part of you that was everlasting or eternal, your soul or your spirit, went there after you died. It was kind of like, I used to say it was kind of like being trapped on the Scottish moors in a Sherlock Holmes movie without the Hounds of the Baskervilles. The Sadducees thought that Sheol, which is the realm of the dead, it's like Hades in Greek thought, that Sheol would continue to go on forever. The Sadducees didn't teach that God was going to come and destroy the earth.
More speculators.
Yeah. But when Jacob or Israel learns that Joseph is still alive, and he says, it's enough. Yeah. I can die a happy man, go to Sheol. So you went there, good or bad, it was not, in some ways the equivalent of what the Catholic Church used to teach about limbo.
Yeah.
You know, before Chubby Checker ever got there, that's where babies went. It was neither good nor bad, it was just a place. If babies died, that's where they went. Because they hadn't had a chance to go to know enough to go to paradise, and it was not right to punish them, so they just went there, and it wasn't good or bad, and they didn't know the difference.
Well, didn't Jesus teach away all this stuff?
When Jesus teaches in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus in Luke, they're both in Hades. The side of Hades that's known as Abraham's bosom is where the soul went to await the final judgment, and then it would go to be with God in paradise. And the other side of Hades was where those that would eventually go into the flames in Gehenna would go, and they would start being punished there. And when you got to the gates of Hades, you were basically judged there, and you went to one side or the other, an angel would take you, and that was it. In the New Testament, Hades is, and so Jesus teaches that there is punishment and there is paradise, and you're going to go one place or the other. It's not hanging around in Sheol. And in the New Testament, Hades and hell are not the same place. And hell is permanent and Hades is temporary. In fact, in the book of Revelation, at the end, Hades gives up its souls, and then Hades is thrown into the lake of fire in hell and burned up. Yeah, purgatory is in part based on that idea of purging, that there would be a time and a place of purging after death. In later Old Testament Judaism, it's based in part on Jesus, on the teaching of the Pharisees about Hades. By the time Jesus is born and teaches, the Pharisees taught there would be a bodily resurrection. There was Hades, and that's where you went, and went. Your soul's eternal, so it's got to go somewhere to wait for the end in the body. It didn't go on and in the body. So that was kind of part of their teaching. And so that's a place of purging, because the rich man, when Jesus teaches about the rich man, he's over there being tormented. So he's in that place of purging. So in part, based on some later Judaism, based on the teaching of the Pharisees in the first century before Jesus and beyond, in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, and then later church teachings, they come up with this idea of purgatory. Well, the point of purgatory was, if you die with sins on your soul, you're not pure enough to go to God. Therefore, you have to have those sins purged from your soul. You have to pay for them somehow. So that's the basic thing behind purgatory. That Jesus does come, and Jesus takes care of all of your previous sins, including original sin, when you accept Him and you're baptized. But then you commit actual sins, and if you die with actual sins, you've got to be purged somehow before you can get into heaven.
Looks like God being the ultimate judge, things would be instantaneous. This sounds to me like creativity on mankind.
Well, they teach almost every. They prayed for Mother Teresa because she was in purgatory. That was the teaching. I mean, she, even though she has gained sainthood, she got out of purgatory to become, because she didn't have that many to be purged. But she went, to purgatory.
See, that's somebody judging her.
Praise God. Well, but, you have to understand, they trace as the vicar of Christ, that is, the representative of Christ on the earth with the authority to rule and to teach authoritatively, back to the Bishop of Rome, and they say Peter was the first Bishop of Rome because Jesus said, "To you I give the keys of the kingdom." Now, Jesus, I think, was speaking of Christians in general, the disciples in general, and the keys of the kingdom are about forgiveness and love and care, but they take that very literally, and what you bind on earth would be bound in heaven, and what you loose on earth would be loosed in heaven. So they take that very literally to mean that the Bishop of Rome, which they say Peter was the first Bishop of Rome, therefore the first Pope, and his successors after that, as popes, have the authority. Now, in all of those millennia, there have only been two times that a pope has declared his teaching to be infallible. But when he teaches with authority and doesn't go against church doctrine, then that's to be accepted. And so as the church doctrine developed, this is what came out of it. I have problems with it, but that's what came out of it. And the authority that folks within the largest branch of the church give to, but not all of them do. Some of them question the Pope, but and right now probably the strongest areas in the world for Roman Catholicism and that kind of way of view is third world. But the Sadducees don't even believe in this kind of stuff, a resurrection. And yet they come to Jesus and they say, who said there's no resurrection? They ask him a question. Teacher, Moses wrote for us, if a man's brother dies and leaves a wife that leaves no child, the man must take the wife and raise up children for his brother. That was levirate marriage.
How about if he's already married?
He still has to do it.
But he has to have two.
He is supposed to. The next one in line is supposed to, or if it's a younger one, the oldest one is supposed to have children for him. Now, in the time of Moses, there was a sense, in the time of Abraham, one of the ways that you gained immortality was to father children, in particular sons, who would carry on the family business and the family name and the family line. And so if you died without any male heirs, that was a horrible thing. So with Moses and levirate marriage, with the law of Moses, you come up with this, okay, well, a brother has to take her as a wife and have children for his brother so that his brother's bloodline continues on. And this is where I get really facetious when we talk about this one, because it says, there were seven brothers, first took a wife died, left no children. Second took her, died, leaving no children. Third likewise. And the seven left no children. Last of all, the woman also died. In the resurrection, whose wife will she be? For the seven had her as a wife. First of all, if I'd been Jesus, I would have said, check the insurance policies. Secondly, I would have said, you guys don't even believe in resurrection, so what are you trying to do? Because they didn't believe in resurrection, and what they're saying is, in the resurrection, and they don't even believe in it, they're trying to trap him here.
There's still a mentality of people, when we all get to heaven, your family is going to be there. And Jesus pretty much eschews that right there. He says, no, there will be of the angels.
Well, and what he says,
in other words, there's right. Going to be a marriage.
Well, he says they will neither marry nor are they given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. Yeah, they're not. You know, he said you're not going to have marriage ceremonies. You're not going to have the angels lining up somebody going down the aisle in front of God's throne to get married. Jesus said, "Is not this why you're wrong? That you know neither the Scriptures nor the power of God." So you really don't even understand the Scriptures, much less God's power. For when they rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. And as for the dead being raised, have you not read in the book of Moses, in the passage about the bush, how God said to him, I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He is not God of the dead, but of the living. You are quite wrong. By the way, what he's saying here is, even death can't annul God's power and sever God's power. Gamaliel, the great Rabbi Gamaliel, used to use Deuteronomy 11. He used to use Deuteronomy 11, 9. And that you may live long in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers to give to them and to their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey, to argue that since God said to Abraham and others, you will live in it and your descendants after you, that after they died, at some point God raised them up from the dead so that they could get the inheritance and then pass it on to their children. Talk about kind of out there arguments, but that's what the rabbis did. That God raised the patriarchs to give them the land. So it's absurd to think that God pledges to a dead person unless it implies that the person will be raised to new life. So Gamaliel, who actually was a Pharisee, used to argue with the Sadducees and say there is resurrection afterwards, because right here in the book of Deuteronomy it says that God raised the patriarchs to give it to them, so therefore they're raised to life, so there is resurrection. So what Jesus is saying according to Mark here is, you guys, you don't even read the Scriptures and pay attention to it, because Moses said in Deuteronomy that God raises them from the dead, but you say there is no resurrection from the dead.
Yeah.
Well, but within Judaism, you have to remember back then in the ancient world period, but especially within Judaism, what did they see as important to have? Land, servants, animals, and even David will talk in the Psalms about, you know, God, you know, giving people, making them prosper. And when he says prosper, they're like trees transplanted by streams of water, and everything they do prospers. He's not speaking spiritually there. He's talking about they're going to get.
Well, you know, when you die, you're not taking that stuff with you.
No, you don't hook up a U-Haul.
You don't have anything when you get there,
man. Yeah, you don't hook up a U-Haul trailer. But they were interested in that, and that the heritage would follow them into the afterlife. And the Pharisees believed that heritage would follow them. And if you were good, once you went and you were on the side of Hades that was going to paradise, once you went there, they believed you would be rewarded and you would have money and servants and that kind of stuff.
Well, what are you going to do with
it? And what are you going to do with the bigger mansion on the other side of the tracks? Or the stars in the crown that, you know.
I want a hut on the beach and a rocking chair.
Yeah.
You remember that movie, The Searchers? And
yeah,
Moses?
Yeah.
Yeah,
but you know, that's human nature to think and to want those kinds of things. And so, you know, even, I mean, growing up, I used to hear people all the time say, you know, so-and-so died and said, boy, but the way they were such a good Christian, you know, they got a bigger mansion. Or you know, they've got, you know, and somebody do something and say, boy, they just earned another big old star in their crown.
Who's going to be the servant to maintain it?
I've been listening to that song. You got mansions that's on the hilltop.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, so, and but what Jesus is trying to say is here, you know, you guys aren't even paying attention to the scriptures, and you're trying to trap me by doing something that's not even scriptural. And then he goes on to say, you know, you need to remember, God's not the God of the dead. You know, when she dies, who's she going to be married to? So God is the God of the living. And it's not just living here, but it's everlasting life, living there too. They are raised. You are raised, and God is the one who raises you to life. Therefore, by God's power and authority, resurrection will occur. He is not God of the dead, but of the living. So you're quite wrong. He said, in other words, by the power of God, there is resurrection. You guys are wrong. So Jesus there teaches there will be resurrection to life. There will be resurrection to everlasting life in the presence of God. Or not. And Mark assumes his readers are believers, and therefore resurrection is part of the salvation experience that they'll share. I mean, really, what have we taught people for millennia, at least centuries, if not millennia? Why do people, most people say they came down an aisle, or whether it was at a Billy Crusade or in church, they came down the aisle to get saved. Why? So they could
go to heaven.
I hear it. So I can go to heaven. So I can go to heaven. Don't want to go to hell. I want to go to heaven. And quite frankly, for a lot of, you know, for a lot of our lives and many before us, that was the primary focus of the evangelistic message that the preacher gave. Get saved so you won't go to hell and you can go to heaven. Jesus says there's more to it than that. But he does say there will be life after death. And it's the life after death because of the power of God. And that's what he's saying here. He said, you shouldn't be worried about whether you're going to be married or not. He said, they're not going to have marriage ceremonies. They're not going to give people away in marriage. What you need to worry about is where you are in life with God now and later. Are you going to be among the living or the dead? Is what he's saying here. Well, one of the Pharisees that's there listens. And he's paying attention to what Jesus is saying. He's paid attention to how Jesus paired off the Herodians and the other Pharisees. And he's paid attention to how Jesus has handled the Sadducees. And so this scribe, and I say Pharisee, the scribes were a subset of the Pharisees. He's a lawyer. Jesus says this lawyer's not far from the kingdom of heaven. You mean lawyers? No. And one of the scribes, one of the lawyers, came up and heard him disputing with one another. And seeing that he answered them well, that is Jesus. You know, because he's paying attention to this. He knew the law. The scribe knew the law inside and out. So he's listening. He says, okay. Which commandment is the first of all? The rabbis were constantly arguing about greater and lesser commandments and greater and lesser sins. And, you know, they wanted, and they would talk about which commandments were greater than others and which one carried the most weight. And so he's coming here. Some people have said he was just trying to dovetail on what these other guys, I've had folks say he was trying to dovetail on what these other guys were saying. If he could catch Jesus off guard, then he's put a feather in his cap in the eyes of all the rest of the scribes and Pharisees. Others, he genuinely wanted to know, and I think given his answer, he genuinely wanted to know. I don't know if it was to win an argument or he was more curious, but because of his answer to what Jesus says, I think he really wanted to know. Jesus looks at him, and I'm sure some of the other scribes and Pharisees and Sadducees were waiting for him to say, come follow me, and then they'd nail him. But instead, Jesus goes to the one place that they can't argue. He goes to the heart of Judaism and the heart of the law. Jesus answers with a Shema, which was supposed to begin and end every pious Jewish male's prayer. Only he adds something to it. The first is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. Now, Shema actually says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength." Jesus adds to it mind as well. It's not just about feel good. It's also about your decisions, because your mind and your heart, you make those decisions. And so Jesus defines this qualitatively for the whole person, not just part of the person, because it's the whole person that will be saved and live for God or not. By the way, this was part of what every Israelite male was supposed to recite every day for, you know, in the morning and in the evening, and at other times to pray. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words which I command you this day shall be upon your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. And you shall bind them as a sign upon your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes, and you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." There were also other places that they were supposed to recite from Deuteronomy and from Numbers. But the other part, so Jesus says, boom, he nails them. There's nothing they can say about this. You know the heart of the law. But then he also adds to it Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, which says, "You shall not take vengeance or bear any grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself, for I am the Lord." So he puts together as one, loving God first and foremost with all of your being, and correspondingly loving your neighbor. Jesus says the greatest commandment is both vertical and horizontal. If you truly love God, then you'll love your neighbor. And you can't truly love your neighbor without loving God. There is no greater commandment than these. And the scribe said, "You're right, teacher. You have truly said that he is one, and there's no other but he, and to love him with all the heart and with all the understanding and all the strength." Notice he leaves out the mind. "And to love one's neighbor as oneself is much more than all whole burnt offerings and sacrifices." And this is why I think the scribe really wanted to know what Jesus thought. He really wanted to know, not to trap him, but he really wanted to know. Because when Jesus says that, he turns around and said, "You know, you're right." And he knows the law, and he begins quoting it from Deuteronomy 6:4 and Leviticus 19:18. And then Jesus shocks the people in the audience. May have even shocked that guy. Because he praises the scribe. And secondly, he offers them an invitation. You okay, Judy? He says, "And when Jesus saw that he answered wisely," and Jesus understood he wasn't trying to trap him, "he said to him, 'You're not far from the kingdom of God.'" He said to that scribe, "You understand more than all these other people do, and you're not far from the kingdom of God." But I agree with Schweizer. Given, you know, I don't think Jesus just was letting it lie there like that and say, "Hey, good job, go on about your way." Because Jesus was about offering opportunities. Schweizer says, "In addition, this is an invitation to take a final step from not far from to into the kingdom." End of quote. In other words, what Jesus is saying, you're not far away, so why don't you come on? Take that last step. And after that, no one dared ask him any questions. I mean, the Pharisees have tried to trap him. The Herodians have tried to trap him. He's taken them down. The Sadducees have been ridiculous in trying to trap him. He's taken them down. And now this Pharisee asks this question, and they're all on pins and needles and leaning forward in their seats, waiting for him to say something they can hang him with. And he says, "Love God with all of your being, and your neighbor as yourself." And the Pharisee then looks at him, and with all these other Pharisees and Sadducees around, he says, "You know, you're right. Can't argue with that. You're right." And in this scribe's answer, he is basically saying not just that Jesus is right, but he said, "No reason for me to condemn you." Because if he condemns Jesus, then he's condemning the law of Moses and he's condemning himself. So Jesus here is also offering him, I think, the opportunity. The opportunity. You can stay not far from, or you can take that extra step. And he continues to teach in the temple. But we'll pick up there and finish chapter 12. Finish chapter 12 next time and move into chapter 13. Well, chapter 13 begins by telling him that Jerusalem's going to be destroyed. So much for the number 13, right? So 12:35 is where we'll pick up next time. Thank you all. God bless you. Go in peace. Be careful. And see, y'all have taken that step from not far from to into. There you go. I finished early. Well, earlier compared to usual.